Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economic hole got even deeper today. Another 240,000 jobs gone. The unemployment rate is 6.5% and climbing. The president-elect held his first news conference and acknowledged what he's up against.
We are facing the greatest economic challenge of our lifetime, and we're going to have to act swiftly to resolve it.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 7th of November. It's great to have you with us as Marketplace covers the financial crisis fallout. The economy shrinking in every way imaginable. Today, the news was about jobs. So far this year, we've lost 1.2 million of them. The unemployment rate hasn't been this high since 1994. Jobs seem to be the top priority for President-elect Obama. That's what he led with at his news conference today.
First of all, we need a rescue plan for the middle class that invests in immediate efforts to create jobs and provide relief to families that are watching their paycheck shrink and their life savings disappear.
We're joined now by our Washington Bureau Chief, John Dimsdale. Hi, John.
Hello, Scott.
We know from the campaign what President-elect Obama wants to do in general. But, John, at his first news conference, did he give us any more specifics?
Not really. He was pretty short on details. He said he favors another stimulus package and hopes that one will pass even before he takes over the White House. And if not, he said that would be his first proposal as president. He specifically mentioned an extension of benefits for the unemployed and aid to cities and states. Those are the things that he wants in a stimulus package.
And what about industry? What did he say about that?
He called for more government help for the auto industry, which he called the backbone of U.S. manufacturing. You know, given the warnings this week that one or more of the big three car makers may go bankrupt, he said that his economic team is exploring some sort of government support to help that industry retool to build more fuel-efficient cars. But he didn't say how much or how such subsidies would be delivered.
John, there have been a lot of questions raised about the rescue package passed by Congress a few weeks ago. What is Obama thinking on that front?
He said that his team is going to review the bailout to make sure that it really protects taxpayers and isn't unduly rewarding banks and other financial firms. But again, he doesn't want to mess with what Treasury is doing. There's a risk of sending markets mixed signals if he starts talking about doing one thing with the rescue plan while the Bush Treasury Department is doing another. That could be counterproductive.
And over the long term, I know that he's focusing on the middle class. But beyond that, what is Obama's long-term vision as we can see it at this point?
You know, he was asked if he still plans to raise taxes on wealthy Americans, and he backed away just a bit on that, saying everything's going to have to be reviewed to see what's best for the economy. But otherwise, he essentially repeated his talking points from the campaign today. He resisted calls for immediate specifics to address the financial crisis, saying, you know, I'm not president yet. There's tremendous pressure on him to get very specific on what he plans to do to restore some confidence in the economy. But it's still 2.5 months before he has any power. He said that appointments like Treasury Secretary will be made in the coming weeks. He said he's working with deliberate haste, but he stressed that it will be deliberate.
John Dimsdale in Washington, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Now more on the employment numbers out today. The Labor Department said 240,000 people lost their jobs in October. For those people, the consequences are obvious and immediate. They don't have a paycheck anymore. But when an economy continues to lose large numbers of workers like this, that means everyone is affected. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more on that.
The dismal unemployment numbers were a kick in the shins the economy really didn't need. Retail sales are already down, but they're expected to decline even more as newly unemployed consumers put a death grip on their wallets. John Fisher teaches business at the University of San Francisco.
There's a classic trickle-down effect where if you're losing a job, it is going to put certain purchases, especially large purchases, at risk, like cars.
But Fisher doesn't think foreclosures will increase because of higher unemployment. He thinks the housing crisis has bottomed out. He says there aren't many homeowners left who are so close to the edge they'd have to stop paying their mortgages if they lost their jobs. But economist Joshua Shapiro of MFR Consulting shoots down that bit of optimism.
In every economic cycle in the past, foreclosures have risen considerably as people start getting thrown out of work in big numbers. And I don't see why it's going to be any different this time around.
And even if people aren't getting thrown out of work, they're still cutting back on spending. Hourly earnings aren't keeping up with inflation. And economist Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute says some consumers are underemployed.
Weekly earnings fell because people they just can't get as many hours as they want.
Shierholz says those people might be a step away from a pink slip. She expects the unemployment rate to rise to at least 8% by the end of next year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The $700 billion rescue package was in many ways for the banks. But we're starting to hear grumbling from the banking industry about this plan to buy problem assets. The program's known as TARP. On Monday, there's a big meeting between the Treasury and the banks to talk about TARP. A securities industry trade group just came out with a survey, and it found that financial players are so unclear about how TARP would work, they aren't sure they want to participate. Here's Ashley Milne-Tite.
The Treasury's plan to buy troubled assets is less than 2 months old, so perhaps it's not surprising the financial industry still has its doubts. Tim Ryan is president of the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, or SIFMA. He says, by all means, get the program underway.
Our view is that the most important thing they can do, meaning the government, is to initiate the asset purchase program so that we can get price discovery.
Meaning clarity on prices. Companies want to know how much they'll receive for their troubled assets. Ryan says right now, financial firms that hold those securities have no idea what they're worth because no one's buying. Bert Ely is a banking consultant. He says because the market isn't setting the prices, the government's going to have to. One way is simply to negotiate.
But that becomes very complicated for hard-to-value assets. There's also a potential for pricing abuses and controversies.
He says if the government ends up overpaying for assets, that's great for the financial institutions, but bad for taxpayers.
On the other hand, if the government price is too low, then banks will be unwilling to sell to the government because they would have to take too much of a loss.
Many in the industry have voiced exactly those concerns. They're hoping for some answers on Monday. SIFMA expected around 100 people to attend its curtain raiser on the Troubled Asset Relief Program. 500 have signed up. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Considering how we've started this show, you might think Wall Street didn't have a happy Friday. But I have a surprise for you when we do the numbers. It's been quite a week for the history books, that's for sure. The country voted in its first African-American president, and by most accounts, he's inheriting the worst economy since the Great Depression. Let's dive in and take a look at the week in politics and the economy. I'm joined by Jos Warsaw. He's the head of global markets trading at Union Bank. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
And Jerry Seib. He covers the political scene for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being here, Jerry.
Happy to be here.
Yos, last week people were feeling okay as the stock market started climbing back up, but what happened this week? We had a couple of pretty bad days.
We did. I mean, the beginning of the week was positive. We saw a market move up, anticipating getting rid of the uncertainty in the political scene. We got the election over, and since then we gave up 7 or 8% in equity indices. And we still have fundamental issues we're working through here. So the run-up we've seen in the last in the prior week and a half, I think, was a little ahead of itself. We set ourselves back a little bit. We were ending the week at a much healthier level.
And, of course, the election being the big story this week, Jerry, you were just at the President-elect's press conference, his first news conference today. He didn't give a lot of details, but he did talk about the need for a stimulus package. And so far, a lot of that's been focused on the idea of big public works projects to create jobs. How effective do you think that can be?
That is the subject of a lot of debate. Some people think big public work projects really don't have much immediate stimulative effect because obviously a construction project takes a while to work its way through the system. That plays out over time, not over days or weeks, but months and years. The reverse argument is that if that money's in the pipeline, if states see there's money coming for infrastructure projects, they let contractors know work is coming, have heavy equipment makers know there are contracts and purchases to be made. People keep their jobs even though the projects themselves take a while to play out. It's a priority for Democrats. They like this. Republicans like the idea a lot less. And that's in part because nobody is quite sure what the actual immediate stimulus effect of those kinds of projects really is.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about some other possibilities here. Yos, you represent bankers and traders, I guess, in this scenario. How do you feel about some of the policies you've been hearing from the Obama campaign?
I think obviously that's a monetary issue and that's a fiscal issue, and they represent the fiscal issue. Reality is the market are much more focused on getting the markets to clear again, start working again. In other words, the monetary side of the house. So the markets are factoring in at this point, I think, some kind of a stimulus plan, maybe $100 billion coming in the next 6 months or so. But markets are much more interested in who's going to kind of continue to fight the wars that are being fought out there. And I think we were a little disappointed that we didn't get some kind of hint today or even an announcement of who's going to pick up for Hank Paulson. So I think there's obviously lots of speculation on who's going to pick it up. Are we going to continue the current path that we're on, which I think we will? We need to understand who's going to be in that battlefield appointment, and we need to understand that pretty quickly.
Well, Jerry, who's on your short list for Treasury Secretary?
The two names most prominently mentioned are Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, the president of the New York Fed. I think the argument for Summers is in part that he's an experienced guy who's done the job before. It gives you the added bonus, if you're Barack Obama, of allowing Tim Geithner to stay in the job he's got, which is pretty central. He's been the link between the markets and the Paulson Treasury Department. He could continue to play that role and give you some continuity. So I think the pairing makes a lot of sense. I don't know that that's what's going to happen, but I get a sense there's a lot of serious thinking in that direction.
And Yos, who do you like?
I like Paul Volcker with Tim Geithner as the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. I'm not sure he would take the job, but that combination, I think, is the dream team. The experience and at the same time the young guy with the continuity to what has happened in the last couple of months. I like that team.
Yos Warsaw, he's the head of Global Markets Trading at Union Bank. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Jerry Seib, he covers the political scene for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Jerry.
Happy to be here.
Most people aren't gambling with their money right now, in the stock market or in Las Vegas. Today, two of the big casinos, Harrah's Entertainment and Trump Resorts, both turned in quarterly losses of more than $100 million. But this weekend, nine poker players will be betting big in Vegas. They're sitting at the final table of the World Series of Poker. The tournament started back in July, and it'll end Monday when one player has all the chips. The top prize is more than $9 million. But the winner might have to share some of that money with investors. Amanda Becker reports from Vegas.
On the first day of the World Series of Poker in July, the Rio Casino was packed. More than 6,000 people huddled around green felt-covered tables. They'd each chipped in $10,000 to play in the Texas Hold'em Poker Tournament. And even though the air conditioning was on full blast, the players were feeling the heat.
Yes!
Oh my God, what a river!
Only 10% of the players will get what they call into the money. The rest will go home with nothing to show. Those odds weren't good enough for Christopher Gamble, a 23-year-old Las Vegas resident who couldn't afford to lose $10,000 out of his own pocket. so he approached an investor to fund his entry fee.
I know I'd staked a few people in tournaments, so came to him and another group. Basically, just between the two groups, whoever gave me the best offer I took for the $10,000 stake.
Gamble sold a percentage of the money he might win in the tournament to an investor who was willing to pay the entry fee. Yet there was no paperwork, no signatures, and no contract. The deal was based only on Gamble's word. It might seem like someone who makes a $1 million deal without a contract isn't playing with a full deck of cards. But investors like Sean Deeb say they aren't worried. He staked a dozen players in the World Series of Poker this year.
They want to stick in the poker community. They can't just stiff a backer. Word will get spread pretty quickly that they weren't keeping up with their deal. They're unethical. They cheat, steal. And in general, like in the poker community, you definitely need to have a good reputation.
And reputation is exactly how backers like Kyle Wilson find good investments.
We staked about 50 guys this year, and we got about between like 5 and 25% of 50 players. We know who can play, and we take a piece of them, and we recruit them, and they come to us sometimes too, but mostly we recruit them.
13 of Wilson's players won money this year. As more players become interested in poker through popular internet gaming sites, there are more opportunities for investors to recruit promising players. Jonathan Grotenstein is the author of All In, the almost entirely true story of the World Series of Poker. He thinks that as the ranks of players swell, the agreements between investors and players might not be so casual.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time before some shrewd poker players figure out how, you know, anybody with just a few clicks here and there can invest in something much larger and literally have people trading the futures markets in poker players.
And as documents and contracts establish poker as a legitimate business venture, it could pave the way for even more kinds of investing.
Now, as poker players have realized that they're going to be taxed on these winnings and at a high rate, they are, of course, going to make their backers step forward. And that probably, you know, more than anything, will help to create a lot of these legally binding documents.
To skittish investors hit by Wall Street's recent woes, trading poker futures might start to seem like less of a gamble. In Las Vegas, I'm Amanda Becker for Marketplace.
Coming up, debating life without roommates.
I guess I felt it was finally time to grow up. But maybe growing up isn't all it's cracked up to be.
But first, let's do the numbers. Lousy unemployment figures today, but Wall Street actually expected worse. And there are a lot of stock bargains out there right now. The Dow shot up 248 points, almost 3%, to close at 8943. The NASDAQ added 38, about 2.5%, to end at 1647. And the S&P 500 climbed 26 points, about 3%, to finish at 930. For the week, though, the indexes all fell about 4%. Today, energy companies really cleaned up. ExxonMobil gained more than 6%, Chevron and ConocoPhillips about 5%, but GM fell 9%, saying it might run out of cash next year. Yahoo was down more than 12%. Microsoft says it has zero interest in buying Yahoo. And Sprint Nextel was down after a weaker-than-expected quarter. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. President-elect Obama and Michelle Obama will meet with President Bush and First Lady Laura Bush at the White House. The embassies of France, Poland, and Denmark will hold a conference in Washington on the challenge of climate change. and the Kennedy Center will honor the late American comedian George Carlin with the 2008 Mark Twain Prize for Humor. I'm Allison Gilbert.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Kai Rizdahl this Friday. It must be painfully obvious to retailers that this holiday season will be cold, dark, and stinging. The sales numbers that came out this week were awful. It was the worst October in about four decades. So it's probably going to be an old-fashioned Christmas of frugality. But the stores aren't giving up. They're getting a little retro themselves and bringing back an old standby. Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
Ah, the holidays. Time to decorate the tree, put on 10 pounds, and max out your credit cards. Last year, Americans spent about $475 billion during the shopping season, more than a quarter of it on plastic. Not this year, says Candace Corlett, president of WSL Strategic Retail.
We have a third of shoppers telling us I'm less likely to put things on my credit card now than I was a year ago. So there is more of a pay-as-you-go mindset.
In other words, a return to a ghost of retail past. Layaway. If you remember the Isley Brothers, you probably remember layaway. You pick out what you want, the store puts it aside, you pay a little bit each month, and take it home when it's finally paid off. Credit cards pretty much made layaway obsolete, but retailers that kept their programs, like TJ Maxx and Marshalls, say business is booming this year. Kmart has made layaway the centerpiece for its holiday sales strategy.
Exclusive Kmart layaway. Get the hottest gifts on your list now. Pay a little each week and pick them up in the nick of time.
Kmart VP Terry Brophy says when credit began drying up, they knew layaway would make a comeback. It lets customers pay a little bit at a time, and it also lets them get dibs on stuff now, so they don't have to risk some hot item won't be in stock by the time they've saved enough money.
Customers that perhaps had not thought of layaway, you could just see the light bulbs going on in their heads. So we knew early on that this was going to be big, and boy, it has already been really big.
Brophy says more than a million customers have used layaway so far this year. Smaller retailers are also getting with the program. At Lush, a posh shoe store in Los Angeles, model Rain Thomas shows off a pair of $400 sandals she just picked up on layaway.
Silver platform stilettos with rhinestone encrusted straps. They are gorgeous.
Thomas says she's putting her entire Christmas list on layaway.
I am getting iPods for my brothers because they need to catch up with technology. It's just easier for me to put all the items on layaway and pay it off, and then at Christmas, they're ready to go.
For the iPods, Thomas is using eLayaway. The online service has deals with more than 1,000 retailers, including Apple and The Gap. eLayaway's Michael Bolello says this is Layaway 2.0.
We've got travel on there. We've got day spas who do offer Botox. We've got restaurants who offer gift certificates and large party packages. I've seen someone lay away an entire hair transplant for $12,000.
Bolello says eLayaway signs up about 1,000 new people a day. The average customer picks out about $600 worth of stuff and pays it off over 3.5 months. That's not exactly the instant gratification plastic offers, but model Rain Thomas says it has other benefits.
When I do finally get that item, it's mine. It's paid off. That makes me feel a lot more responsible and more grown up than when I was 18 years old and I was buying things on credit cards that I couldn't pay back.
And with layaway, you can scratch pay credit card bill off your list of permanent New Year's resolutions. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
It's a rite of passage growing up. You move away from mom and dad. Then you leave the college roommates and couch potatoes behind and get your own place. Commentator Rehan Salam is finally living alone, but he thinks he might have moved too soon.
About a year after graduating from college, I moved back in with my parents for a few months while I pounded the pavement in search of a new job. Though I eventually moved out, I must admit, I kind of liked it, particularly the home cooking. Later on, when I moved down to Washington, D.C., I wound up in a group house with some close friends. Living with friends was a lot like living with my folks. We'd occasionally share meals, and we'd bond during Werner Herzog movie marathons. We also threw massive boozy parties, which my parents would probably have frowned upon. Overall, it was pretty great. But even so, I've just moved into my own one-bedroom apartment. So why did I move? I guess I felt it was finally time to grow up. But maybe growing up isn't all it's cracked up to be. For one thing, I'll have to shell out lots of cash to make my new apartment look remotely civilized because, apart from towering piles of books and clothes, the only furniture I own is a single chair. And who can blame me? Do you have any idea how much a bed costs? I think I'm going to sleep in a huge pillow fort instead. Then there's the environmental impact. A pair of Michigan State scholars found that divorced families used 73 billion kilowatt hours of electricity and 627 billion gallons of water more than they would have had they stayed together. Now, moving to an apartment of my own isn't exactly like getting divorced, though I did have a big custody battle with my former roommate over that favorite chair of mine. But it's pretty much the same in terms of its environmental effect. So, is single urban living dead? Well, we're already seeing more adults living with their parents. Ritzy apartment buildings are offering more shared spaces for people to socialize. We're even seeing old-school communes make a comeback. And the rising cost of energy and housing in our most desirable cities doesn't help. It's enough to make even the most plucky individualist want to crawl back into the womb. Now, if only my mom and dad hadn't rented out my room.
Rehan Salam is co-author of the book Grand New Party: How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Send us your thoughts at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat, now available at splendidtable.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
Chicago had a pretty good week. The whole world was watching that party in Grant Park on election night, and now the city's trying to capitalize on being the home of the next president. Chicago's tourism website urges people to experience the city the Obamas enjoy. There's also a new 3-day Barack Obama getaway promotion. You get to walk by Obama's home in Hyde Park and take a driving tour highlighting Obama's impact on Chicago and the world. Hey, in this economy, everyone's looking to make a buck. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 248 points, 2.8%. The NASDAQ added 38 points, about 2.5%. And the S&P 500 gained 26, almost 3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yore. Be sure to check out Marketplace Money this weekend, where the theme will be your tax bill. Next time on this program, why economic predictions sometimes fall on deaf ears.
I certainly feel that I've been crying in the wind and no one listens.
I'm Scott Jagow. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.